Joseph Robinette Biden Jr. do solemnly swear.
I, Joseph Robinette Biden Jr. do solemnly swear.
Preserve, protect, and defend.
Preserve, protect, and defend.
The Constitution of the United States. The
Constitution of the United States.
So help you God.
So help me God.
Congratulations, Mr. President.
In order to make America great and glorious again, I am tonight announcing my candidacy for President of the United States.
As U.S. President Joe Biden and former President Donald Trump kick off their campaigns ahead of November's election, European leaders are coming to terms with what the potential return of Trump could mean for global trade and security. You're listening to the latest podcast from the German Institute for International and Security Affairs, or SWP for short, here in Berlin. This is where we discuss what's on the minds of policymakers, or at the very least, what should be on their minds. And right now, it's the potential demise of US democracy and a sense of anxiety, even panic, about another Trump term. But as another president almost said, isn't it about the economy or even the currency, stupid? What role does the strength of the dollar play in maintaining America's dominant global position, regardless of who ends up in the Oval Office? I'm your host, Esme Nicholson, and to tackle the US election from a monetary and trade perspective, I'm joined today by Mark Koplovich, Professor of Political Science and Public Affairs at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Mark is currently working on his next book, Dollar Signs, The Myth of American Decline and the Future of World Order. Mark, nice to have you here with us in Berlin. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Also here in the studio is Laura von Daniels, who heads SWP's research unit on the Americas. Laura's expertise include transatlantic trade, finance, and the relationship between economic and security policy, and her current research looks at US export controls and dollar hegemony. Laura, it's great to see you. Thank you for being here today.
Thank you, Esme. It's my pleasure.
Looking first of all at the bigger picture and the United States' position as a global power broker. Should Europe be panicking? If so, what should we be worried about? Mark, perhaps you could start us off.
So panic for me is a term that I find, I guess, unhelpful in the sense that I think there are always things to panic about in international relations. I think Europe should be concerned. I don't know that the issues Europe needs to be concerned about are different if Trump wins as opposed to Biden wins. I think there's a degree of autonomy that Europe is going to have to consider if Trump comes back, both on economic policy and on security policy.
Do you think, though, considering Europe has worked with Trump before, there is maybe a sense of how they might work with him? Or are people concerned that he has better people around him this time around?
Mm-hmm. I think there's a concern that he will have more politically motivated, less experienced people on economic and security policy who are less interested in cooperation, right? And I think that perhaps is the sense of panic. If you think about the last Trump administration on economic policy, you had Steve Mnuchin as the Treasury Secretary, who was someone who could work very well with European economic officials. You had a series of current and former military-ranking military officers who were working on the National Security Council and in the Defense Department that I think European leaders had connections with and felt they could work with. So I think my sense is a lot of the concern is not having those people in office. The conversations that I've had here in Berlin over the year are very much pragmatic, people in various ministries thinking about working at the middle level with their counterparts and that transatlantic relations can continue. But for that to really be effective in terms of actual policymaking, you do need those people at the senior level. And so I think that's where the real concern is, that we don't really know what a second Trump administration will look like, but the quote-unquote adults in the room that were there in 2017 to 2021, it looks like there's going to be fewer of those people in the rooms that are important if there were a second administration.
And Laura, from the German and European perspective, what are people concerned about right now? Or what should they be concerned about?
Right. So at SWP, we collected thoughts from European think tanks on a second Trump presidency. And the result was that many in Europe are worried about the state of democracy, as Mark already said. Then about our own defense, obviously. Freedom from Russian aggression is a major concern. Many see Trump as a less reliable partner or no partner at all. And then there's a concern that Trump will re-enter a trade war. So currently, I would say there's not much common ground on how to react to all this. I would call it a collective action problem at this point. And for Germany in particular, I think it's obvious that we are very vulnerable on the defense side and the trade side. And it's also almost unfathomable for us to think of the U.S. as a partner that is having substantial problems with authoritarian leanings domestically. So we are, so to speak, in a triangle of sadness, democracy, defense, and trade. I wouldn't call it panic yet, but certainly we need to focus and prepare for a second Trump presidency and have a clear sense of the policy areas where change and disruption and also ambiguity is more likely, I would say, on security and trade, and then other areas where we are likely to see more continuity, even with Trump, for instance, China policy or economic security.
Well, we're here today to talk about money, and like the U.S. economy, the U.S. dollar is strong right now and has been for some time. Would this change without Bidenomics, without Joe Biden? And what impact does the strength of the dollar have on geopolitics? How does the U.S. actually use it as a tool on the global stage, Mark?
Yeah, so I think it's important to distinguish between the, when we talk about the dollar being strong, people are often talking about the level of the exchange rate, right, against the euro or the pound or whatnot, versus the dollar's role as the dominant international currency in the global financial system. And so a lot of the dollar being strong and having appreciated relative to the euro is about macroeconomic conditions and interest rates. And the U.S. economy is doing much better than the German and the European economy and the British economy right now. So this is why the dollar has appreciated. Would that change without Bidenomics? Well, you would have some form of Trumponomics, which is probably going to be another round of large tax cuts, which is more fiscal stimulus. So that might exacerbate the you know, strength of the dollar in terms of the level. But the bigger picture question, and this is what my book project is on, is regardless of who's president and regardless of the degree to which there is democratic backsliding, I mean, Laura's right. This is, you know, the problems at home about creeping authoritarianism are very serious problems. But they're probably not in the short or medium term going to affect the dollar's dominance. You know, for the dollar to be replaced as the top international currency, someone else would have to step up. And the really only two options are the euro or the Chinese renminbi. And largely for domestic political reasons in Germany and Europe and then within China, that would basically mean a total reversal of the current economic policies of the Eurozone and of China. And so I am worried and concerned about the future of American democracy. I am not worried and concerned about the continued dominance of the dollar in international finance.
Well, and Laura, how does the U.S. use the tool on the global stage, and how is Frankfurt, for instance, reacting?
So based on the strength of the U.S. dollar, any U.S. government can use restrictive financial and trade instruments easily, and it will continue to use the dollar as a foreign and security instrument. So that's sort of the other side of the privilege exorbitant of the dollar, the privilege. And but there are also, I mean, something can always happen. So it would seriously undermine the strength of the dollar if we saw another major financial crisis. There are also some worrying to dangerous ideas, I think, put forth by some conservative think tanks surrounding Trump, like the idea that the U.S. should stop being a lender of last resort when it comes to another crisis. This would definitely destabilize global markets. And there's another idea about a re-evaluation of the dollar, so a forced devaluation. But I think that in any case, it seems more likely that there will be continuity and the US will remain the dominant world power. And that's based in its the strength of its currency and the attractiveness of its market.
So the message that it's all over if Trump wins may not be entirely accurate, if I understand your arguments correctly, and I sense a pinch of optimism. But what should European policymakers be doing to prepare in both scenarios? Mark, you've already mentioned that, you know, Europe has to step up regardless of who's in the Oval Office. What should Europe be worrying about? And what measures should they be taking? Laura, perhaps I can start with you.
So I'm not sure about optimism, but I think what we should do in the EU is really focus on the two areas, policy areas, where we might see most change with a second Trump presidency. So that's defense or security policy, and then trade. And that's not just because of Trump, but because there are forces in both U.S. political parties that support a withdrawal from Europe or burden shifting. So the question really is what Europe should be doing on trade and the economy first, perhaps. I think there are good reasons to prepare a cohesive strategy to deal with potential tariffs. Trump has often played with the idea of introducing tariffs on cars. That's very important for the German export sector. And the Commission has prepared and expanded its toolbox. It has become more assertive since 2016 or 17. But and there are also ways of responding to unilateral tariffs, either with own EU tariffs or, if necessary, by raising economic costs in other economic policy areas.
And does that enjoy support from all EU members, such policies?
So that's where I think the whole discussion about a cohesive economic and trade policy really matters. At this point, I think there are divergent interests. It's obvious in recent spats we saw between the German and French government. But I think we're getting there, and there's an increasing understanding that we cannot just pursue our own interests and go it alone because we're in this together in Europe.
I see it a little bit that the continuity across the two future possible administrations would be more on the economic side than on the security side. So Trump is much more aggressive, xenophobic, and to some extent erratic with his tariffs, you know, starting the trade war with China in the last administration and whatnot. But the Biden administration has been very protectionist, right? It's blocked the WTO judges, so the court is not functioning. It's not really interested in new trade agreements. And it is continuing, you know, the tariffs and trade war with China. So I think European policymakers need to think, as Laura has been discussing, about what is the EU's strategy for operating in a world where the US is not fully committed to free trade and multilateralism. I think the bigger picture concern is on the security side, right? You're going to have very different policy towards the, you know, the war in Ukraine with a Biden administration versus a Trump administration. And so this is where I think the questions of accelerated and coordinated military investment in some sort of EU-level security strategy becomes very important.
Well, that's something I actually want to address. But Laura, you wanted to come in there.
Yeah, I just wanted to say on WTO, I think Europe should really take it seriously. And with Trump, we know one thing, that personnel is politics. So I think for the next European Commission, it would really be good advice to put a political heavyweight in the position of trade commissioner. And he or she should continue the fight for WTO reform and not give up on it and build coalitions of countries and also pursue further EU trade agreements and then also improve our strength or our position on the economic security side.
Security is another pain point right now in Europe. What would a Trump win mean for Europe's security? Mark, you've already touched on this a little bit. And on the spending that's involved in shoring up security. And what about sanctions and coercive instruments as economic security policy, Mark?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a matter of degree, so there will be different policies between Biden and Trump in affecting European security. But I think either way, this idea of more burden sharing in Europe having to step up and questions about Germany investing in more in security, France investing more in security. You have the Baltic states and Poland and kind of the newer members of NATO and the EU now have really been stepping up. So one way to think about that is in terms of division of labor, right? You know, there is such strong support across both parties, even with all of their differences, for U.S. and NATO that I think you saw in the last administration when Trump talked about walking back from NATO. There was a lot of pushback from the security-focused crowd in the U.S. Senate and the foreign security blob in Washington, D.C. So I don't think you're going to see, you know, the U.S. is going to walk away completely from NATO. But I do think you would see an acceleration of this idea that, well, there are conditions under which we're going to fulfill our obligations and we expect Europe to do more. And so I think Europe needs to have good answers for how much more they're going to do, whether that's going to happen at the national level or the European level. I mean, a lot of the discussions I've encountered here around the Schuldenbremse and spending in Europe is, well, my reaction is if you aren't going to spend more as Germany, right? Or if you aren't going to spend more as France, then more is going to have to come at the EU level. And so I think Europe needs to figure out, we're going to have to spend more on security. We're going to have to step up both more generally with NATO and specifically with Ukraine. And we need a coordinated, cohesive strategy for how that's actually going to happen and where the money's going to come from. And that's the part where I'm not sure yet. In my time here in Berlin, that there's a clear answer or consensus yet about what that looks like.
Well, is that realistic? There's a lot of talk about it, but what's actually happening on a European and national level here?
Yeah, I think although Europe's response may be slow, at least some politicians or increasing numbers of politicians seem to have heard the call. So I think the first thing that European countries or member states, EU member states, need to do is really invest in a strong European pillar of NATO. The EU countries need to increase their defense budgets. That's obvious. But it's not just about the money. It's also about structural change away from a fractured defense landscape. So there are already new initiatives to strengthen the EU defense industry.
Can you give me a couple of examples of those kind of initiatives?
Sure, like a common defense procurement program to increase the production of ammunition, a program called ASAP. There's also a proposal for a European defense industrial strategy and an implementation program coming from the High Representative for Foreign Affairs and Security Policy, Josep Borrell, and there are additional proposals by European think tanks. But clearly, the next front row of EU leaders will have to further pursue these projects.
This question that Laura's brought up of figuring out how to spend more and having a kind of European procurement strategy, one way politically you could imagine to sell this to Trump is that a lot of the weapons that the EU countries would buy would come from the United States, and this would be good for the U.S. economy. So I think, you know, some of this, as an American thinking about this and U.S. politics, some of this is, you know, having clear strategies and specific policies. And some of this, if it's a Trump administration as opposed to a Biden administration, is marketing and sales. Right, and how you will sell this to someone who really thinks in a zero-sum economic way about relations and is very transactional. Right, so if Europe can come up with a way to find the money and convince the United States that it can be a good partner by buying American military equipment, that it might be a politically effective way to push back about the skepticism of NATO. You could imagine Trump then going back to the American voters and saying, I got them all to hit their 2% target, and I fixed the trade deficit because they're now buying more American weapons.
It's a good way of sort of killing two birds with one stone, right? But then there's also, we don't have a common position on that yet in Europe, and I think there are different evaluations of, you know, the extent of the security threat and they're different in Paris than in Berlin at this point. So there's really still a lot of work to do to get there. But yeah, it would be great to reduce, help the U.S. reduce its trade deficit and also increase our security in Europe with one policy. That would be nice.
That's obviously about purchasing weapons, but what about sanctions and other coercive instruments as economic security policy?
Right. So I think with Trump, Europe really needs to prepare for a situation where he unilaterally drops sanctions vis-a-vis Russia. And then we are really in a situation where we need to be prepared and think about ways to protect the sanctions coalition against Putin. And for all of this to happen, perhaps that's not a short-term thing, but it needs to happen. The EU really needs a common strategy and a common understanding of the norms on when and for what political causes and how to apply financial sanctions and other economic sanctions.
We've already asked this question, but will Europe step up both in terms of military spending and in terms of monetary policy? The euro is not the dollar, but it is not insignificant as a currency. What should EU leaders and Eurozone leaders be doing here? And what about Berlin? What role does Europe's largest economy play in all of this, Laura?
Yeah, so as a political economist, I would say there's still lots of obstacles that are related to this collective action problem. But I do think there's sufficient common interest to work together. So it would improve our own security to coordinate our military spending. We've already experienced a major external shock with the Russian war on Ukraine, and that has exposed our weaknesses. So if we take the necessary steps to increase trust in the euro, that would also lay a strong foundation for our economic and political power. So these are things we really need to do. And for Germany, we are a big economy. And I also think that most in Berlin are also aware that we can't go it alone. So we need to contribute more to EU-wide security, not just money, also building the structures. And we should be leading on questions of EU integration and institutional reform. And the same holds true on economic integration. So completing the banking union, the capital markets union, and finding new ways to jointly issue euro area debt for the benefit of all the member states, and to get even to an EU-wide budgetary and fiscal policy. I think these are the things we need to do in the coming years.
Mark, you've been here for some time. What is your impression of whether Germany and Europe is stepping up?
Yeah, I mean, I think whether they've stepped up partially, but not enough yet. But, you know, I think as Laura was mentioning, there's really two options that I see. So one is Germany does more as, you know, to some extent, the hegemonic power within the EU. Right. You think about that as the Franco-German engine, but, you know, Germany is bigger economically. And so one option is Germany is going to spend more. It's going to invest more. That's going to be on security and lots of other things. That's going to involve difficult, politically fraught discussions about the debt break and budget deficits and things like that. And the status quo in Europe of not doing these things at large scale at the European level could continue, but that's going to require Germany and France basically to do a lot more collectively and with their national budgets. The other option, which I think is the one that is probably more sustainable and gets to the consensus that we've been talking about, is that you are going to do this at the EU level. You know, the euro is unquestionably the number two international currency, right? And so when you think about power in the world economy, the international system, it's still really a transatlantic world of the US and the EU together. One of the reasons the sanctions were very effective against Russia is it was the US, the EU, the whole G7 simultaneously that was basically 90% of the global financial system, right? So when transatlantic relations are strong and the US and Europe are doing things together, stuff gets done. If the US is going to be less of a reliable partner, if there were a second Trump administration, Europe is going to have to do more at the European level. The EU could issue very large-scale debt, not just a one-time next generation, you know, EU type of thing with COVID. So the Europe could do that and fund all kinds of things, security included, there's huge political opposition or lack of consensus on doing that, both within Germany and at the European level. So in some ways, you know, as an American observer of this, I don't know that it fundamentally changes the challenges and the political obstacles that Europe has been facing for 10, 20, 30 years now to deeper fiscal political union, capital markets union, kind of European security cooperation. It just makes them more urgent, right? Because there's an ability to free ride on the United States, right? And this is the part about, you know, Trump complaining about NATO and burden sharing and things that I think actually appeals to American voters who don't even support Trump, is there's a kernel of truth about Europe not spending enough on security that people feel like, yeah, it would be fair, even if they don't sort of have all the other concerns about NATO. So I think it will make it much more urgent. And that's where I think a strategy of just let's wait out 4 more years of Trump and then there'll be somebody else again, which seemed to be a somewhat effective strategy from 2017 to 21, is let's hold the line and hopefully a Democratic president will come back and we'll kind of go back to normal. I think this would be a sign that that's really probably not the path that you could go down going forward.
That charge from the US, and not only from Trump, about Europe continuing to free ride on US support, is there a realization that, yes, things do have to change in Europe? In Germany, for instance, in terms of spending?
I think so, because, as I said, it's not just Trump. It's also a shift in the political positions in both U.S. political parties. I also do think that it's a matter of our own interests, security interests, economic interests, to really take the steps necessary for more European integration. It's also about sovereignty. And so we have all the good reasons. We don't even need to look to the US. We should do it for our own sake.
Well, for everybody's sakes, I think we'll draw to a close. That's all we've got time for today. And I'd like to thank our guests, Mark Koplovich and Laura von Daniels. You'll find links to their latest work in the podcast show notes. And if you like what you hear, you can subscribe to us on Spotify, Apple, or wherever you get your podcasts. You can also keep up to date with the latest analyses from SWP on X, formerly Twitter, and on LinkedIn. So until next time, it's goodbye from our guests.
Thank you very much.
It's been my pleasure.
And also from me, thank you for tuning in.